the use of technology, and so we're going to have to try to prove him wrong. But of course, technology always has a way to prove him right. So let's see what we can do here. I'm not going to lecture very much because I think the format lends itself better to a conversation, and there were a lot of very interesting questions in the notes that the group sent, and I think we will use that as a guide to engage in conversations. Just, you know, what I wanted to say as an introduction is to say that, you know, what the theory is both something that has evolved over time and also something that is still evolving. And so many of the questions that you have are also questions that I struggle with in trying to understand what the theory is about. So I think you should see this conversation very much in the context of a piece of work in progress, and perhaps for me as a chance to have a collective conversation about the meaning of the theory and the meaning of this concept. But it's very much, you know, for those of you who are a little bit familiar with this work, you will know that it started in the late 80s in studies of apprenticeship. And basically, the goal of this early work was to rethink some of the assumptions we were making about learning that gave rise to the kind of institutions that we saw in the schooling system in the US. It was very much the enterprise at the time. If schools were failing, so when the idea of the institute where this work started, maybe it is because we are making the wrong assumptions about the nature of learning, and we are building institutions on the wrong assumptions about what learning is. And so I was studying apprenticeship with an anthropologist, because apprenticeship was a mode of learning that had preceded those institutions, and that was not necessarily predicated on teaching as the cause of learning, and was not predicated on the idea that you could extract knowledge from practice, transform it into a curriculum, give it to students in a specialized setting like a school, and then send students back into the world. Yeah. So this is why we were interested in apprenticeship, because it did not have those two characteristics. And so in our early work, we have very much looked at existing practices. For instance, Jean Lay was studying tailoring in West Africa and how young boys became tailors. And so we were looking at existing practices, and we started to theorize learning as a journey into these practices. And so in that first phase, we were not so much focusing on communities of practice. Communities of practice were taken as a background, and then learning was theorized as this progressive journey through different stages of increased membership, if you will. Then I started to do some studies of communities of practice in an insurance company, and I would say this started a second phase of the theory, because the practice that those people were creating in response to the circumstances in which they worked was not pre-existing. It was not a long tradition. It was just that they were finding themselves in circumstances that they didn't especially like. And it was, you know, there was a lot of work pressure on them. And so for them, they kind of created a community of practice in response to the demand on themselves, on them collectively, to achieve something that they wanted to do in order to make the money, right? And so what was interesting there is that in some sense, they were collectively defining a sort of form of competence to exist in that office. So of course there was a job definition, there were criteria that were set by the company for them to get paid. They had to process a certain number of claims. There was an insurance company. You don't need to know the details, but there were quota that they had to fulfill. And then they were kind of forming a community in response to that to enable each other to do that. And also, the community was not just about doing the job. It was also about how we create a livable space to do that job. So it was also, the committee was also very much about, you know, what did you do this weekend? And it was also about how can we find shortcuts to achieve the quota that we have without following the exact description of the job. So it was a mix of creating a certain space to do the work, but also achieving the work, sometimes by following the rules and sometimes not. So there very much it was sort of a collective definition, if you will, of what the competence was in this context. And I would say that now what we're working on is a kind of third version. So what the switch between the first phase of the theory and the second was really a kind of figure ground change that in the beginning, we took the community of practice for granted, and we theorized learning as a journey into that practice. If you want, in the second phase, it's a figure ground shift where we take the need to learn in a social context for granted, and we see a community of practice arising out of that need. So people build a community of practice because they have learning need in a context where there are others who have similar needs. So, theoretically, it's a figure ground shift, but with the same DNA, that there is an important relationship between learners and the communities in which competence is defined. Except that in the first phase, the old timers were the kind of holders of the competence, if you will. And in this new phase, it's much more a matter of negotiation what the competence is. It's much more, it's not like a long-established competence. It's something that people negotiate in response to their circumstances. I would say that now we are in the third phase of the theory where, and actually, you have to understand that I'm not a researcher. So what we do to develop the theory is much more in practice. And, you know, our consulting practice is very much about developing the learning capacity of social systems. And lately, we've been doing a lot of work with communities that involve multiple practices, learning spaces where different practices interact, because the learning problem, if you will, is not just within the practice, but across practices and the intersection between practices. So right now, a lot of our focus is on what we call landscapes of practice, where you have multiple practices constituting, you know, a kind of, it could be something like a field, or it could be like a discipline, to view them as multiple practices interacting. So if you think of education, for instance, the field of education, you have multiple practices, each competing for defining what the field is about, if you will. So you would have research, you would have policy making, you would have administration, you would have teachers, maybe even parents, being different constituencies that contribute to an unstable definition of what counts as knowledge or competence. But theoretically, the big change is that if you look at a practice, at a single practice, then you can really associate learning with the acquisition of competence in that practice. So the more you learn, the more competent you are in that practice. If you take a landscape of practice as your purview, if you will, I'm a little hesitant to say unit of analysis, but it's your purview, then learning is a journey through that landscape in relation to practices where you cannot claim competence yourself. So in this context, we have added a concept in the mix, knowledge ability, which is a relationship to practices in which you yourself are not competent, but you may be knowledgeable about them. And this is, there's a tension between those two things, because to be competent in one practice requires a lot of focus, but it also takes time to develop knowledge ability with respect to a set of other practices. So I just wanted to put this in context to say that, you know, a theoretical perspective is something that evolves, and yeah, the DNA of the practice, the DNA of the theory, which is really this idea that learning takes place in that relationship between the person and the world as socially constituted, remains throughout, but the perspective is evolving, if you will, in response to the need for theorizing and the need for practical implications. So I just wanted to just give you that background on how the theory evolved, where it came from, and you know where we think we're going with it. So, any question in response to this brief introduction? Otherwise, I'll just take the notes that I received, and we'll just go through that. But I would like this to be very interactive. I think that this medium does not lend itself very well to just me talking, because it's very difficult for me to know if what I'm saying is resonating, because I'm not in the room. And so I'm going to need to hear from you in order to know where to take this.
Can I just comment that and check if you agree, Etienne, that, so let's say generation one is in Leibniz-Wenger 1991.
Yep.
Generation two is Wenger 1998.
Yep.
And generation three hasn't been written yet.
Well, there are a little preview of it in a book called Learning in Landscapes of Practice. That's an edited volume that we did with some people at the Open University in the UK.
Can I just ask you, can you pick me up?
Yep.
About that generation of theory, because in 2002 you wrote Cultivating Communities of Practice,
yep.
which seemed to look, for me anyway, and more applications and how, I think at some point we talk about how communities of practice could be generated. But also,
yep.
There are differences, I think, between, I've always thought that there was four generations rather than, because of that book in 2002. Could you just comment on the 2002?
Yeah, okay. So, it's interesting whether you want to see this as a phase of the theory or not. The reason why I presented not as a phase of the theory, but as an implication of phase two, right, is that if communities of practice can be developed by people who come together because they share a learning need, right, then, well, first of all, it so happened that even though initially the theorizing was targeted to education. In fact, it was business that took up the ideas first, you know, because they were trying to deal with things like knowledge management, you know, and they were building computers that could, big databases of best practices that nobody used. So for them, this idea that there were committees of practice that existed in organizations that were almost invisible in the org chart, you know, was an interesting view on knowledge management. Because instead of just building this big database of best practices, maybe what you should do is recognize these informal communities as part of how the organization functions, support them. But then, you know, managers are like this, you know, they're not theorists, you know, they don't care. You know, they say, you know, so if I need one, can I start one, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's almost like a sort of practical implication of that second phase that people would say, ah, you know, all our engineers in, you know, break design, they work in silos, they work in different parts of the business, they never talk. So maybe we should start a community of practice among them so that they don't repeat the same mistakes, you know? So it was a very kind of practical take on the second phase by saying, okay, if naturally people come together when they have a shared learning need to develop the competence together, why can't we just start this? And I have to say that as a researcher at the beginning, I was very skeptical. You know, I was kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, don't touch those, you know? And I have been, it's just, you know, in my sort of practical work, I've had to kind of loosen up a bit by saying, well, in some cases, some organizations have been very successful at not formalizing the committees themselves. The organizations that have tried to do that have run into trouble because they have removed the agency from the communities. But the organizations that have made it kind of a legitimate thing to belong to a community in addition to the team where you do your work have had some success in supporting this dual citizenship, if you will, and making it legitimate to tell your managers, listen, this afternoon for 2 hours, I'm not going to work on this project. I'm going to go and be with my community, and you know, you will benefit from it because really, we there are really good ideas that come out of it. So this is why personally, I don't view it as a different phase in the theory, but as a kind of like practical implication of phase two.
Okay, thank you.
So would you want me to just take up the remarks that were made in the notes now, and we just go through that?
Yes.
A good way to proceed again. So I think the first one is sort of an overused framework for community. I think that it's important not to hang up and you know, the person who said that, it would be great if you push me on it. But I would say, you know, a community of practice is not a community in general. It's a community of practice. You see, the fact that we use the term community to describe it was just, I don't know, we didn't even think about it at the time, the implications of choosing that word. It just sounded good, you know? Because, you know, we saw, oh, there is a kind of community there because people can recognize each other as competent, more or less competent. They can judge each other's competence. They have some criteria for judging each other's competence, right? And, well, that's kind of a community. We could have called them groups, you know, or something. So it is not a theory of community, you see? It is a theory of the social definition of competence. The fact that we call the unit of analysis of the definition of competence a community is just a good or bad choice of term on the part of theorists who were not very very reflective on what they were doing. You know, I think in retrospect, I would say it was a good sort of choice of term, because it forced us to say, okay, how does a committee deal with its boundaries, who is a member and who is not, under what condition is someone recognized as a member, under what condition can you be marginalized by the community, under what condition the power to define competence shifts within a community, and so on and so forth. So this idea that there is a shared allegiance to a kind of competence is expressed by the term community. But there are lots of things that are called community that I would say are not committees of practice. So, you know, like a neighborhood is often called a community. To me, it's not a committee of practice, you know, because there is no, or maybe it could be. That's it. Committee of practice is a question, not an answer, you know. So you could ask yourself, is a neighborhood a community of practice? That would be kind of almost like a research question. It would be a certain way of thinking about a neighborhood. What are the practices that are developed in this neighborhood that are specific to being in that neighborhood? And in most neighborhoods, I think you would come in empty, you know? But there may be some neighborhood where they have, you know, what do you call this? Like when people look at each other's house for thieves.
Neighborhood watch,
yeah. Could see a neighborhood developing a practice of neighborhood watch, then you would start to say, oh yeah, no, this community is not just a neighborhood community, it's getting towards a community of practice, because they have a sense of what does it mean to be good at that, you know? And they devise a way to think about that, you know, even informally. You know?
Well, it's November the 5th here, Etienne, and so I guess there are communities of practice about to go out to set off fireworks and have bonfires, perhaps. But they are kind of, I was thinking of street parties or something like that, that can be more or less competently organized. But nowadays, these bonfires are state regulated and controlled, so that's not really a community.
Jill Evans' book talks about how the Bermondsey bug had to walk in a certain way down the street, if you remember, if he didn't want to get his light punched out. But that's what identified you as a Bermondsey bud that was cool and in control of the place and the situation. Bermondsey being a little tiny strip between two roads in the south of London that extends a few miles out from London. So there was a practice of how you walk, among other things. So that, yeah, maybe there are ways that communities can be written about as communities of practice.
Actually, you're saying that the theory of competency, who defines what competency is? Is it you? Is it the group? Is it an external, or whoever's funding the group, or who defines competency?
So, the elegance of the theory is a social theory of learning, which we are losing a little bit in phase three, by the way, but the elegance of the phase two of the theory as a learning theory is that the answer to that is you need to ask the members, you know. So we had a location for what counts as learning, which was the community of practice, you know. And so there was a good social answer to that question. Now we are losing that a little bit in the third phase, and we're struggling a bit with that, because as a social learning theorist, you have to say, where socially do you locate what counts as learning? Right? That's a very important thing about a social learning theory as opposed to a cognitive learning theory. Because as a social learning theory, it's a very life question. Who defines what counts as competence, right? And so the second phase of the theory, the first phase of the theory was, you know, it's the old timers, you know. The second phase of the theory was it's a negotiation among different claims to competence that constitute the community, right? But you would really want to go into the... You have to look at the perspective of the members to know that. You know, that's what the theory says. Nobody can... Nobody from the outside can define competence but the members. Even if they do it in response to systems of compliance, and that's why, for me, it was powerful to have that perspective in that insurance office. Because, of course, in that insurance office, there are lots of definitions of competence that are external to the community. Because there is a job design, there are criteria for what you have to do to get paid, you know? So the criteria of competence are very well defined. And yet, even there, there was, I don't want to call resistance because it's too beautiful a word, you know, but there were local agency in defining locally what it meant to be good locally. You see what I mean? So even in a prescribed an environment and this insurance office where the company was really, you know, invading the definition of the job in very exact details about, you know, what you should put in that line. You know, I mean the company had completely invaded the practice, if you will. But even there were local dimensions to the definition of competence. So the idea is that, of course, there are external prescriptions, but the practice is a response to these prescriptions, never simply the effect of those prescriptions. That's what's really essential about the notion of a committee of practice. So even compliance, if you will, is a production of the practice, of the community in its practice. Someone mentioned that the theory might be descriptive rather than analytical. What do you mean by that?
Allison.
Okay. But is it something that people feel that's a problem? I would say probably the reason why this is said is because the theory really takes at face value the experience of the members. And it's both its strength and its weakness, right? So unlike Fairclough, for instance, the theory would not go and say, I know better than you what you are saying, because I can analyze your talk through a discourse that you are subconsciously reproducing. So it's not a theory that has that analytical power. Yeah. So in that sense, I think it is probably weak or descriptive, if you will, you know. So it is not like people were talking about Marx or Foucault. It is not saying, you know, you have false consciousness, you know, and you contribute to your own exploitation. And so I know better than you, as an analyst, I know better than you what you do. Okay, so it's not a theory like that, you know. And so in that sense, it is weak. But it's also useful sometimes to take what people say as an expression of real competence, even if it's counterproductive or self-exploiting and so on and so forth. So in that sense, it's maybe viewed as a descriptive theory.
But if it's not analytical, what does it produce? What's the point? If it's not analytical, what's the point of doing it if it's not producing something, if it's just saying this is what is there and you're not producing any new knowledge?
Or, it gives you the language and the tools and the framework to talk about something which is there. That's how I found it.
Did you hear that, Etienne?
Yes. Yeah, and I think that in a sense, it's not a structural theory, okay? So sometimes people confuse analytical with structural, you know? So in that sense, it's not a structural theory, but it is still a theory that tells you what to look for if you are interested in the local definition of competence. It is still a theory that say, okay, look at the identities that people are building in that context. Look at the artifacts that reify that competence and how those artifacts interact with different forms of participation to generate experiences of meaning. So it is still a theory that tells you what kind of questions to ask and what kind of things to look for, but it doesn't give you a structural frame to look at local as an expression of the global, if you will, or something. I don't know if that makes sense of what I'm saying. But that is why you need plug and play, because if you want to do that, you're going to have to plug and play that locally focused theory with a theory of structure to see how the two interact. But the plug and play is important, because if you accept the plug and play, then you will accept that those mothers that Erica was talking about, they are not simply puppets of a structure. There's a local definition of competence that is sometimes in conflict with broader definition of competence, if you will. But it's saying they are agent. These mothers are agent in the collective, in their own collective definition of competence, and they struggle, obviously. So if you plug and play with the theory of communities of practice, you will never accept that structure has a direct effect on the experience of competence that people have. It's always mediated by local context of negotiation, if you will, where structure is renegotiated into practice in ways that involve some level of agency. Now, it may break down, the theory may break down, you know. So if you think of a concentration camp in World War II, and you read those experiences that people had where really their agency was broken down by the system. So there are extreme times where the theory doesn't work, I would say, you know, because the institution is so overbearing that people lose that ability to define competence locally. Which brings us obviously to the whole issue of power, right? That a number of people brought up, and which is very important. So, it is both, with respect to power, I would say that the theory is both kind of humble and strong. It is humble in the sense that it doesn't have, like Bourdieu, a kind of overall view of power. Okay? Because it is a learning theory, it is not a sociological theory. So it is not a theory of the structures of power in society. You know? But at the same time, as a learning theory, it is imbued with power. Because if competence is something that is socially negotiated in specific social contexts, then learning and power cannot be separated. Because any moment of learning is a claim to competence that is subject to acceptance or refusal. And that's true for a little baby who is speaking his or her first word, right? Is that first word accepted as competence or refused as competence? You see what I mean? It's like, there's no moment of learning that is not, from this perspective, that is not a moment of power. Because competence is always socially judged. And therefore, whether you judge somebody else's competence or whether your competence is judged, it always involves relationship of power. Who has the right to say you are not being competent right now? So, you know, it's almost like a, well, first of all, it's a learning theory, not a theory of power, as I was saying before, but it's a learning theory that takes power very seriously. But power almost with a small p, not power with a big P, okay? And that is why, just to jump ahead a little bit in the question that you were asking about it being a structural, a static theory. I think that's a misunderstanding of the theory to think that, you know. Because competence is never fixed. One way to think about a committee of practice is as an unstable equilibrium between multiple claims to competence that are negotiated with respect to each other. So in this theory, change does not require more explanation than continuity. On the contrary, continuity requires to be explained. If a practice doesn't change, you need to explain that. You need to explain that. Is it that maybe the power to define competence is so unevenly distributed that there is no renegotiation? Is it that the artifacts have so taken over the practice that participation matters less? And it's very difficult to change, like the QWERTY keyboard or whatever, you see what I mean? So it's a theory that both at the level of claims to competence is always unstable, because it's always possible that some other claim to competence is gonna move things. It's also a theory, you see. If you have a social learning theory, you need to have a social theory of memory, because you cannot have memory, you cannot have learning without memory. So a cognitive theory of memory talks about cognitive structure, a neurobiological theory of memory would talk about synapses and neural connection. This learning theory, which is a social learning theory, has a social theory of memory. And that is this notion of participation and reification. Okay? That in a social context, memory is a dual process of developing a form of participation over time, which is a little bit like the habitus in Bourdieu. It's a set of predispositions that come from your participation in the world, and reification, which is the objects that are created by practice. And these two forms of memory always give rise to meaning in interaction. So meaning is always an interaction between reification and participation. So they are always necessary to each other. If you look at meaning as an important DNA of a social theory of learning. But what is interesting is that they are not locked into each other. You see? They are necessary for the negotiation of meaning. but they live in space and time in different ways. Does this make sense? So an artifact can live long after the forms of participation that gave rise to it have disappeared. That's what archaeology is about. You take artifacts that you find deep in the dug in a little piece of pottery, and you try to say, okay, what kind of form of participation would make sense for these artifacts to be the way it is? But so the reification can outlive the participation because it lives in a different realm, if you will, of memory, you know. And the other ways are the other way around. You can lose an artifact, you know, or you can renegotiate an artifact. That's why laws don't enforce themselves. You need judges to interpret the law, because the law is one form of memory, but you need that participative form of memory to give laws a life in practice, if you will. I don't know, I'm talking a lot. I would like to hear if this is resonating with what you want to know. But I think it's important not to assume that it is a static theory. On the contrary, but it is true that artifacts tend to last a long time, you know? So, that is true, and it is true that forms of participation can be encrusted in people's identity in ways that are not that easy to change. But the fact that those two forms of memory are not in lockstep create a certain dynamism, if you will, in the negotiation of meaning. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Is that asking a question? One of the criticisms of community practice theory is it doesn't have a theory of change, which would kind of fall in line with people's criticisms that it's static. But what is the process of initiation of change within it? How, in a sense of agency?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to claim, and maybe it's a weak claim. Is that it doesn't need a theory of change, because it is not a theory of structure. So, you need a theory of change if you think that continuity does not need explanation. Okay? But it's a theory that requires as much explanation for continuity as it does for change. Why is it that a practice doesn't change? You need to explain that, because it is as likely to change as to stay the same, according to the theory. So I think that we need to be careful when we say, what is the theory of change in this theory? Not to assume that, oh, but you don't need a theory of continuity then? No? I don't know if this makes sense, but I think it's an important way that the theory is misunderstood, I think. That practice stays the same until something happens. That is not what the theory says. Practice is always contested, always contestable, and it's a miracle that it doesn't change more than it does. You have to explain that. There are probably, that's where issues of power come in the way. Yeah. If only the old-timers have power, for instance, then I think you can start explaining continuity. But that was the first phase of the theory, where only the old-timers had power. In the phase two, it is no longer assumed that the old-timers are the ones that have power.
Can I ask a question about locality, please? If you might get, perhaps at one school, you might get a group of school teachers who define competences in a particular situation as one thing. But they're still part of a wider community of primary school teachers, and there are thousands of primary schools in England. So how And there are different ways of school teachers to communicate with each other. But what happens if you have something that is generated very locally in just one place? Is that still, are they part of a layered community, or how does that work?
So this is a real, very important question, James, and something that we are currently struggling really hard, you know, because if you start looking at landscapes, you know, you lose the original locality, if you will, okay? And so it's a theory that's very geographical, in the sense that if competence is negotiated in social interactions, then scale is going to be very problematic. And so you see that in teachers. In the UK, you see that. You see that struggle very much. Because one way to deal with scale is to remove local agency and say all teachers on Tuesday, February the 5th at 2 o'clock are going to teach this, and they're going to do that, and they're going to ask these questions. So you can gain scale by verticalizing practice, if you will, and removing local agency. But it's a very dangerous way to gain scale, you know, because when you remove local agency, that has serious implications for the kind of identities that can be developed. And you see that in all sorts of places where attempted scaling create a removal of local agency that is very destructive. So people become disengaged, people perform jobs in a perfunctory manner, you know, because it's a view of scaling that does not take local definition of competence seriously. And, you know, that has a lot of implications for what learning means, you know, and what identity means. So, yeah, it's a theory that predicts that scale is going to be hard, you know, because the verticalization, which is the way that scale is often thought of, you know, in an industrial terms, if you will, has serious there's a price. You see, if you have a purely cognitive view of learning, then verticalization does not have a price, because if everybody agrees with something, and that something is true, there's no price from a cognitive perspective. From a social theorist perspective, there is a price. Because if you believe something is true and you have no agency is defining why this is a competence that is meaningful, you know it very, very differently than if you have agency in defining that as competence. So, you see what I mean? It's a theory that says knowing is different from knowledge. That engagement in practice is different from prescriptions of practice. I don't know if this makes sense, but it's a very, very important dimension of the theory. Especially for things like, how do you organize quality at scale? That quality at scale is going to be very hard, according to this theory. And I think there is empirical evidence that it is.
I think Fiona had a question.
I've got a question. Yeah, go ahead. I know you're working your way through some other questions.
No.
Okay. And I'm interested about how community practice as a theory responds to individualism, because I feel like what we do, we live in a society where that sort of, that notion of the individual and the power of the individual to sort of, you know, to do what they want to do is a thing that's really celebrated. You know, it's part of a kind of neoliberalist sort of kind of ideology, I guess you could say. So I'm interested in how does community practice respond to an environment where a whole bunch of people are fundamentally in competition with each other? So, or maybe they're, we know that work has been deregulated, and so people, you know, that they're working in isolation, or they're just, you know, on short contracts, and so on. How does, where does communities of practice, what does it say about that?
Okay, so communities of practice as a theory itself is not a theory of neoliberalism. It would have to be plugged and played. So you'd have to say, how does neoliberalism comes about? By different communities making that happen. That's a different question.
Yeah.
The question of individualism in sort of the experience of the world. So the theory has an answer to that, you know? And the answer of the theory to that is goes something like that. If the definition of an identity of competence is a relationship between communities where this competence is negotiated and the development of an identity, if we take this as a DNA of the theory, and we now place that perspective in the world historically, I think that what we find is that in earlier days, where you lived mostly in one community your whole life, in some sense, the community was doing a lot more identity work than you, right? All you needed to do is to belong, and you inherited this identity. You see what I mean? Now move towards the 21st century, where the journey of a person traverses many, many, many communities, some of which you belong to, some of which you can't belong to, some of which you don't want to belong to, some of which you would rather not know about. So this kind of rupture of the parallelism between community and identity creates a shift of the burden of identity from the community to the person. Now, this is really important to understand. This is not a theory of individualism. It is not saying we are moving from a social world into an individualistic world. Not at all. It is saying in that relationship between communities and identity, how is the burden of competence, how is the burden of knowing what it means to learn? How is that distributed? You see what I mean? So, if in the second phase of the theory, we had a very elegant way of saying, what counts as competence? Because we had a community to tell us, yeah, you know, this person is a good pianist. No, this person is not as good a pianist. See, but they can judge. These people can judge each other's competence because they have, over years of practice, developed criteria for it. So it is a very elegant theory, you know, because we have the location of what it means to learn. If you start thinking now about this shift of the burden from the community to the person, you're still within the same theory, you know, but it's much more difficult to say, are you knowledgeable about physics, you know? Well, what counts as truth in physics, you have nothing to say about that, you see? It's not your community. You have no way to negotiate competence and say, no, the age of the universe is not 15.4 billion, it's 15.2. See what I mean? Yeah. But still, you know, the age of the universe has something to do with what you imagine yourself to be. It's still having an impact on you. You see what I mean? But do you choose? But you could choose not to believe that, you know? Like in the US, we have communities that don't accept that. They say the universe is 6,000 years old. Because if you look at the Bible and you count the generations, you get about 6,000 years. Right? So there are communities who don't accept that view of knowledge. You know, they define a different kind of competence. And so you have these different forms of competence competing in the world. And in some sense, you have the burden to decide which of those two you'd like to subscribe to, if you will. Do you know what I mean? And in a university, everybody would say, oh, all those people in the south of the US, they're just stupid, you know? I mean, how can you believe that? And I agree, you know, I tend to subscribe to the physics. Because that's what knowledgeability is. You see, I have some understanding of their method. And I think that the methods of the physics community is more reliable. I personally think that the methods of the physics community is more reliable than the methods of the Bible Belt. But in some sense, there's more burden on me to make the decision. Does this make sense?
Oh, I think Anna's got a question.
Hi, I'll speak loudly. So, are you in the work you're doing now? Are you looking at how individuals take knowledge from one community of practice to another? How what happens where those interactions, that sort of transfer of competence or knowledgeability, how it can you take ideas from one community of practice into another? Are you looking at that sort of thing?
Yeah, so that is not new. Yeah, so even in the phase two of the theory, we had a concept of broker, yeah. You know, of someone who took an idea into practice and brought it into another. So that has always been part of the theory, you know. But the notion that learning capability is a characteristic of a system of communities rather than a single one, that is where this is new. And the concept of broker, which was, I would say, maybe a background concept, you know, it was not a central concept in the phase two. It was more like, okay, yeah, and so there are people who go from one community to another and broker a piece of competence, if you will, or a piece of practice. That has now more salient in the third phase of the theory. So it's not that things completely change, because the theory is still kind of like of the same family, if you will. But certain concepts have more of a foregrounded salience in the kind of question that you ask. So now, even in our practical world, we pay a lot more attention to brokers than we did in the past, because we realize how important their role is to the social learning capability of a given system. Because we realize that the fragmentation of practice into different communities, which is unavoidable, is a problem, you know, for learning to happen at some level of scale.
You know? So you're using the words, you're talking about, when you say system, do you mean a landscape of communities of practice?
Yeah, at a broader level of scale than a single community. And even within single communities, like, for instance, if you think of the of engineering or something, it happens in multiple levels of scale. So there are these both issues of scale within given disciplines and issues of scale across disciplines. Yeah. So to me, that's an interesting realization, actually, that's something that actually I have learned through these courses by talking with you guys, is that as a theory evolves, certain concepts takes more salience than others, you know? So like even in the first phase of the theory, the concept of community of practice was background. And the main concept was legitimate peripheral participation, the trajectory in the second phase of the theory, suddenly, boom, it's a community that's foregrounded. And the fact that legitimate preferred participatory right is one way of learning. But there are many others. There are many ways to learn from a community than to become a full member, you know? So it's interesting how, you know, certain concepts gain salience as you try to explain more phenomena. And I think that relates to a question that comes later, that this notion of falsifiability. Because somebody was saying, but so maybe this is not a falsifiable theory because it's observable in the world. I think that it is, again, a different kind of theory than the kind of, it's not a theory whose purpose is to create claims of truth. It's a theory whose purpose is to give you a certain perspective on what matters. And so, yeah, it is not falsifiable in the traditional Popperian sense, you know, because it is not meant to be a claim to truth. It's meant to be a claim to what matters in the world if you want to understand certain phenomena. So the validity of the theory comes in the kind of question that it makes you ask in certain contexts, whether this is useful or not, for what you want to say about that context, you know? I don't know if this makes sense, but I think that's...
I think Bernard's got a question.
It's interesting about your foregrounding, because in 2000 you wrote a paper which kind of focused very much on brokering and social systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to me that was all, that was kind of very helpful in terms of how different communities of practice can be interconnected.
Yeah, I was running a little ahead of myself there. I have slowly caught up. But it's true, it was a paper that I wrote that was, well, I think I was a little ahead of myself. That's true. I had not realized how important what I was seeing then turned out to be.
Yeah.
Huh? I don't know if this makes sense, but... because you have some intuitions, you know? I think intuitions are an important part of how you build a theory, you know? And then, you know, some also the response of people, you know? If you come up with a concept, you have an intuition, oh, this is important, and then nobody responds, nobody thinks it's useful, you cannot say, oh, maybe it's not that great, maybe I thought it was great, but... So, you know, it's kind of like, it's not the same as the natural sciences, where it's really the data that tells you whether your theory is right or wrong, you know? It's more complex in the social world, because the social world, we tell stories about the world, and we focus on certain dimensions of the human experience. My experience is that theory that tries to reduce everything to one explanatory mechanism are a bit annoying, you know? No, because the human experience is richer than, you know, the relationship with your mother, you know, it's important, it could be, I'm going to get myself into trouble here. And it's not to say that any of those very important things like, you know, family dynamics or class conflicts or gender issues, all these are important, but they are all facets of the human story, you know? And if a theory claims that it gains analytical power by reducing that to one thing, generally for me, I'm not very attracted to these kind of theories, you know? And it's not to deny that one thing is not important, but to say we have to be careful not to have kind of science envy, you know, and say, oh, okay, so, you know, physics can reduce everything to, you know, the grand unifying theory of, I don't know where they are. I think they're still having trouble, you know. But quantum theory seems to have made a lot of progress lately. You know, even Einstein was wrong, apparently. Okay, so, you know, you can explain everything with one principle or something. I think I don't know if it can happen in the social sciences, but I think that the history of social sciences is not very kind, I think, to that ambition. I don't know. I'd like to hear what other people have to say, because it's a kind of controversial, I know it's a controversial position. But I talk about horizontal theorizing as opposed to vertical theorizing. So I think community of practice is more a horizontal theory than a vertical one. Because it depends on your experience. See, the theory of the age of the universe is vertical in the sense that it doesn't depend on your experience. It's not something you can derive from experience. It's not something that is enriched by your experience. It's just something that people who have instruments that you have no access to can claim to know. And so it's very vertical as a way to know, right? The kind of knowledge that I feel I'm generating is much more horizontal. It depends on your experience. And somebody was saying, you know, if the theory is recognizable in the world, does it make it useless because it's no longer falsifiable? Well, I would say in this case, it's one of its qualities, that it is recognizable through people's experience. It gives a language to what people already know. But it still matters to have that language. It's not that it is useless, you know. The fact that you have a language to recognize something that was not salient before, not salient enough to talk about before, is a progress in understanding.